All right, wonderful. Yes, as I said, my name is Roy, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't drink anymore, and that's a pretty interesting thing for an alcoholic, to not drink anymore. My sobriety date is April 7, 1982, and it's by the grace of God and fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I found out how to do that, you know, how to go one day at a time without taking a drink. Because before I got here, I really truly didn't know. And, you know, I'm here to tell you what happened. Well, I should say what it was like. Excuse me, what happened and what it's like now. And for me, I grew up on a farm in Ohio. I have three other brothers, or had three other brothers. I've got one that didn't make this program, and he shot himself about 98 or so. And in any case, he's not here anymore. But for the grace of God, there go I. That's the solution I would have probably took as well if I hadn't found AA. In any case, we grew up in the country and stuff like that, and I remember my first drink. It's interesting, I can't tell you when I ate my first pizza or when I smoked my... Funny how that is. Can't remember when I smoked a cigarette or, you know, this or that or the other thing, but I was 10 years old and I remember the first drink. I went down to my cousin's place, and his dad had made some pear cider. He did it all the time, and he put it in barrels and stuff like that. Well, we'd seen them drinking it, you know what I mean. It was hard cider, too. He didn't drink it sweet, trust me. And so anyway, we got a jar of it, and I went ahead and we drank the jar, and I didn't remember, you know, I can't tell you I blacked out this, that, or the other thing. I don't remember anything significant at that point in time, but I never forgot it. It did make a lasting impression in my mind. And about 13 years old is when I started drinking again. And the reason I started drinking again at that time, I mean, of course, I was up for it, but when I was in school, I was the same size just about that I am now, a little thinner, but I looked like a grown man, and there was like 15 and 16 years old in there that were just getting their driver's license and stuff, and they had no idea how they were going to get any booze, but, you know, I had the attitude and the size and everything, and so they elected me to go in and buy the booze and give me a cut of it in exchange for my services. And that rung well with me. So the first time I ever did it, you know, I got like a bottle of wine, and my cousin and I went out on a dirt road and in the middle of nowhere, and he and I got smashed, and I remember throwing up, you know. I got puke and dropped that night. And another thing about me, that's followed me all through my whole drinking career, is that when I get drunk, I get sick, and I puke all over the place. And anyway, I thought it was great. You know, I mean, I couldn't wait till the next weekend and we do it all again. And looking back now, you know, that's kind of unusual because I'm the kind of kid I hated to be sick. Just absolutely despised it. You know, if green beans had made me vomit all over the place and heave my guts out, I would have never, ever, ever ate another green bean. You know? But I didn't even consider that as being related to the booze. You know, the fact that I didn't like to get sick, it was just the way it was. And that's what came with the territory. Oh well. And so I don't know, we'll stepping back, quit that echo. Is that better? Push it this way. Okay. Is that it? Okay. All right, so anyway, yeah, I was a crazy kid as a teenager. I was always getting in some kind of trouble and getting kicked out of school. I was rebellious, you know. I can remember when I was a little shaver, my dad used to tell me, and he was a strict kind of a guy, he would, you know, he laid the law down, and if you broke it, you paid the price. That's simple, and he'd let you know. And he'd tell you, boy, if you do this, Roy, you know, I'm just going to have to, and it never bothered me that he said that. The only thing that bothered me is whether I wanted to do it bad enough or not. Because there were times when I was willing to take the heat for whatever I wanted to do. You know, because I was going to do what I wanted to do, and I didn't care what anybody said about it. So I ended up getting kicked out of school a lot and stuff like that. I was always a prankster and a jokester in school. And, you know, some of the things I did were I put a dead cat in a teacher's dress drawer one time. You know, I'm telling you, they didn't see any humor in the stuff I did. You should have seen the look on his face, though, when he reached in there and got a hold of that. He thought he was getting his book out. But anyway, as time went on, you know, I did things drinking and as a kid like that on the weekend that, you know, they didn't bring any immediate trouble, but I got into scrapes and arguments and fights and things that I wouldn't have done left to my own devices, let's say without alcohol. And I remember one time, as I graduated from high school, I got out of school, and this friend of mine that was going to Vietnam, a lot of guys went to Vietnam back then, and if you were called, you know, you didn't know if you were coming back or not, and you might come back busted up and everything. And so we always tried to have a nice going away party for these guys, because we might not see them again, you know. And so anyway, I went to the party and everything, and the next morning I got out of bed and I was just like sore and stiff, and I just didn't know. I stumbled out of the house trailer I was living in, and my buddy, good buddy, lived next door to me, and I said, man, good God, what's the matter with me? I'm sore, you know, I just feel awful. And he said, you don't know what happened? And I said, of course. And, you know, what do you mean, what happened? You know, hell, I was there. I know what happened, you know. And he says, well, you and so-and-so got into this fight, these two other guys, and one guy was stomping and kicking me on the back, and I'm fighting with one guy in the front and stuff. And I didn't remember any of it, absolutely none of it. And I didn't even know at that time that I had blackouts, you know. That's the first one that I became aware of, that I was capable of getting into something and, you know, not have any recollection of it at all. I went back in the house and looked in the mirror, and sure enough, man, I was black and blue all over the place, you know. And it had been a real knockdown dragout, and I was amazed, sort of shocked, you know, that, gosh, I could go out just to have a little fun, you know, and the last thing I remembered, we were yucking it up, and I don't know anything about how this fight got going. And what happened as a result of that, I wasn't happy with the behavior that I, you know, exhibited when I was drinking. And at first, that was a nice way to put it, you know. But in the end of my drinking, I damn well hated my guts for the stuff I had done that I couldn't seem to stop doing in spite of myself. You know, I ended up marrying my high school sweetheart, and we had two kids, which incidentally, my kids are here tonight. This is the first time they've ever been here with me speaking. And so if I fall out or anything, I'll let them finish the story. But anyway, hopefully I won't embarrass them, and hopefully they won't embarrass me. If I make a mistake, tell me about it later. But anyway, we had the two kids and everything, and I remember, like, when we first got married, one time I went to my ex-wife's girlfriend's New Year's Eve party, and I came to the next morning, and I know I'd been drinking a lot. You know, I'd been into the beer, and we stopped on the way for the mixed drinks, and then when I got to the party, I brought a fifth of Seagram 7 with me, and, you know, so I'd had a whole bunch. And anyway, she proceeded to tell me, because when I woke up, I couldn't believe what had happened. I mean, it looked like a tornado had been through there. I was laying on the floor, and geez, there was holes busted in the walls and this and that and the other thing around there, you know. And I said, what the heck happened here? You know, I mean, and she says, you don't know? And I said, no. I mean, you know. And she said, well, you did that. And I said, I did? You know, I was clueless, absolutely clueless. And this is another thing that happened to me in my drinking, was that I always got away with this stuff. And I look at my drinking career in the past, and, you know, if somebody did that to my house, came into my place and tore it up like that and knocked holes in the wall and this and that and the other thing, I'd call the cops and you'd go to jail if I didn't throw you out the window or, you know, beat you half into the ground or something. But they did nothing. You know, they just let it pass. And and of course, not being a nice guy, I didn't offer to pay for anything that I'd done. That was out of the question. So, in any case, I begin to regret my drinking, and as I said before, I begin to hate myself, because these are the kinds of things that I did, and I never knew what I was going to do. You know, I had no clue. And so, of course, the best thing to do for that is to have some more to drink. And I had got a business and one thing and another going up there at the time, and I was fairly young. 20 or 21, I had a business and all that. And anyway, I just more or less decided I wasn't being treated right. You know, they were picking on me or doing this and that and the other thing. And I had a brother working for me. He'd gone to a Thanksgiving dinner, and I was the subject. I wasn't there. The reason I wasn't there was because I used to arrange family parties like Christmas or Thanksgiving. I'd say, well, when are you going to have dinner? And they'd say, well, at 2 o'clock. And I'd say, okay, well, I'd show up at 2 and leave by 3. And, you know, I was either drinking or partying, or I'd tell them I was working or whatever, but I mean, I was absentee. And I'd done that for a while, and they were all talking about what an SOB I was, because I wasn't there ahead of time, or, you know, and I was cutting everybody short on being with the family and all that stuff. It was like I treated them like an appointment. You know, I would get there, and then I had other things to do. And so anyway, my brother that worked for me told me about this, and I was furious. You know, how could they talk about me after all I'd done for them? You know, I was highly offended. So, and the thing that really clinched the deal was my wife wouldn't talk to me after that. I mean, I came home that night and she was there and everything. She just wouldn't speak. And the next day she just wouldn't speak. And no matter what anybody said or anything else, you know, once in a while a woman will do that. Any of you that haven't been married, and, you know you're in trouble, but you don't know how to get out of it. Anyway, I just sat around and I thought, well, you know, to hell with them. If they don't think that, you know, I'm all this bad stuff, well, I'll just pick up and leave. And that's what I did. And it was like a Friday afternoon. I told my wife that I was going to go to the bank. And I just neglected to tell her it was Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And So when I got there, you know, it was great. I mean, it was a great place to drink. I mean, gosh, in Ohio, they closed the bars at 2 a.m. And, you know, I found ways to get around that and still drink, but it was tough. And in Fort Lauderdale, they closed at that time for a half an hour in the morning between 7 and 7:30. And anybody could take that. You could sit in the parking lot and go right back in, you know. So I was in heaven. But in any case, I always worked and kept a job and stuff. I always thought that my drinking, like right after work and stuff like that, was because of the job, the pressures of the job and so on and so forth. And it just seemed to fit. You know, I felt better when I could, you know, relax with a few drinks and all that. So anyway, I was in South Florida a couple of years. And in that time, my wife got displeased with my behavior or what was going on, one thing and another. And anyway, she left with the kids and didn't say where she was going. She gave me some of what I gave her. She just took off too. And so I waited about a month and I filed for divorce. And anyway, we got divorced, and then now I partied all the time down there, and I was not a nice drunk. I went into the clubs and places down there. They used to have some really fancy places. I don't know how it is anymore. It's been a long time since I've been there, but I might have cured them of running a tab in the bar. They had an imperfection in their system, and I pointed it out to them. I loved to go into a bar, and I would see the tourists, you know, that they all didn't have suntans, and they'd be burned a little bit here and there and one thing another, you know. And, of course, being local, I would go in and start spewing my stuff, and the whole time, being a hero, I'm buying everybody drinks and all this and that and the other thing, and at some point, I would excuse myself to the bathroom and leave. I remember one time at a Big Daddy's down there, I went in and I was having a few drinks, and this gal was sitting next to me at the bar there, and she says, "I just know you from somewhere." I know I do, and this and that and the other thing, and as it progressed a little bit, she came to and remembered, and she said, you know, she started cussing me up, upside down and everything, and sure enough, she'd been in the lighthouse or the light something club, and that's where she worked, and I'd done that in there. She knew who I was, so, you know, and I, of course, slithered out the door. But anyway, it didn't change anything. But I saw a lot of stuff happen to me down there that I just didn't know what was going on. One of them was fear, terror, paranoia, and bewilderment. You know, I had an apartment that I wouldn't answer the phone in and things like that because I was drinking. I would just go out every night after work and get such, you know, shit-faced, pass out somewhere, so on and so forth. And I remember even one time, and I think of this, God was looking out for me all along because I came home from work and was drinking one thing and another, and I had a fresh bottle of MD 2020. I was going out somewhere partying, and when I came to the next morning, I was laying in the door. I had, like, unlocked. I'd gone wherever I went and come home, and as I opened the door, I just went in with it. I was laying on the carpet there, and my MDs all spilled out front of me, everything like that, you know. And God knows when I came home, or, you know, I don't know, the keys were hanging in the door of my apartment, you know. I blacked out right there, passed out and everything, you know. And but nobody robbed me, nobody came in, nothing, you know. So, but in any case, the fear, terror, and paranoia got to me so bad I started seeing a head shrinker, and at one point, now I tried to use things to make drinking work. One of the things that I did when, you know, this throwing up stuff, my dad had caught me when I was about 16. I come in and threw up all over the bed and stuff, and he told me, "Boy, if you ever come in this house again and do that, I am going to clean your clock." And so I knew, you know, that I had to make some adjustments. And you know, it's not fun to wake up like that, you know, getting your clock clean. So, in any case, what I started doing is I'd come home and I'd run my finger down my throat and just heave myself clean. So there was absolutely nothing left. And when there was nothing left, I would go in the house. And that way I could pass out in the bed there and it'd be spinning and, you know, all this stuff. And I'd just lay there and gag my head off and nothing ever come up. Anybody out there wants to use that, you're free to use it. It really works. It does. You get up with fresh sheets and everything. But anyway, I did other substances along the way to try to make drinking work like that. And I always wanted to be drunk. That's the point of it. I wanted to be shit-faced and smashed. And when I passed out too soon, like at the apartment, I don't know if I went to the party or I came home. You know, I just was passed out and missed all the fun. And so I tried to use drugs to make things like that work so I could stay up longer and not pass out and this and that and the other thing. And when they didn't do whatever it was I started to do them for, I quit. I just simply had no interest in anything like that. I set them down and walked on because I didn't get the result that I was looking for. And in any case, getting back to this fear, terror, and paranoia stuff, I had talked to the head shrinker, and they put me in a Baker Act thing in a hospital down there. And when I was in there the first time I went in, I had got busted in there for being drunk, because I was drunk, you know. What happened is when they took my clothes and stuff and they put me in a second or third floor or whatever it was, I saw where they put my clothes. And so being thirsty kind of guy, I went ahead and got my stuff as soon as they got me in, and I went out to the liquor store and I bought some pints and put them around my belt and stuff like that. And it's, yeah, when I changed clothes on the first floor, I started up, and of course, you know, some of them fell through. We had busted glass and whiskey all over the place. And believe it or not, you know, it's funny how an alcoholic can find another alcoholic, because believe it or not, there was another gal up there just as, she was as thirsty as I was, you know. And she could use a drink too, so that's what we did. But anyway, I got busted in there, and the head shrinker told me, one of the things he told me is, he says, like, you know, if I had problems like you, I'd drink too, you know. And the other thing is, he diagnosed me as a paranoid schizophrenic. You know, when I think about that, you know, he didn't understand. A paranoid schizophrenic, of course, is a person that thinks you have people after you and they're out to get you. And of course, being an alcoholic, I really did have people after me. There was a lot of people out to get me. But anyway, he told me he could fix me up if I'd see him after I got out with some pills and come to his office, and $60 or $70 an hour. And I told him, no way, man. Black Label's $1.80 a six pack. And, you know, nobody even suggested I had an alcohol problem, you know, that time around. But in any case, I ran into this friend of a girl I was dating, her mother, and she, of course, we'd been to a lot of parties and stuff. I dated this girl for a while. But anyway, I'd gone to a doctor and to try to get some nerve pills, because, you know, as I experienced the pressures of the day and the job and stuff like that, I get pretty nervous and upset and stressed out and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, well, you know, maybe they had some pills that take care of that and just take the edge off, and then I could, you know, be more relaxed at work and everything. And I went and saw this doctor. Now, mind you, when I walked in, the kids, my daughter will remember this, because she loved these platform shoes that I had. She was nuts over them. I had the 3 inchers, man, belt on the pants. Yeah, big old hair, lame chops, all burns. One cool dude. You know? And, I went to the doctor, you know, and I told him my problems and everything like that, you know. He had the nerve to give me a drug abuse lecture. He even charged me for it. And I was telling this lady's boyfriend about this one night, at how, you know, how disgusted I was at the medical profession, you know, because they'd done that to me. And he'd never seen me when I wasn't drunk, so he didn't know what sober was, you know. And in any case, he said, well, you know, Roy, what you described to me sounds like withdrawal from alcohol. And And I said, well, no. I said, that doesn't have anything to do with it. I said, but as a matter of fact, I'll tell you what. I found I don't need his drugs or anything else. I said, I just stop at the morning around 10:30, 11 o'clock, throw down a quick couple Bloody Marys, and I'm fine. You know? He said, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. He said, well, you know, if you think you have a problem with alcohol, come to some meetings and I'll take you and show you and stuff like that. And he told me he'd been sober 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just found that hard to believe because he'd been to parties and everything else. He said, no, Roy, it's ginger ale all the time. I never drink anything. So he said, just check it out, you know, if you want to go. He said, you're not sure whether you got a problem or not. He said, go this weekend, but I'll drink and report back to me Monday. And I said, sure. So that was going to be no big deal. I'd never tried to really stop drinking. Why would you want to quit, you know? Anyway, so that was on a Thursday, and I found that I was drunk on Friday, and I said, well, still got Saturday and Sunday. That's the weekend. So lo and behold, I got drunk Saturday. Man, I just didn't believe that, you know, I could do, but that was Sunday. And then, of course, I got drunk Sunday, too. And it's like, man, you know, I really, truly wasn't going to get drunk. That's what I thought. You know, I just wasn't going to do it. And so I told him the truth that I got drunk every day. And he said, well, come on to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did, and that was in Hollywood, Florida. I went to the first meeting I ever went to down there. And I saw people in there that, you know, I mean, they had what I wanted in a sense, but I didn't know what it was. And I thought they were all just incredibly rich because they didn't worry about anything. They turn it all over. You know, but for the grace of God, they're cool. And the way I thought was the only way you could be like that is if you had more money than God, you didn't have to worry about nothing, you know? And I told him, I said, well, you know, his name was Bob. I said, Bob, holidays are coming up. This is coming toward the end of the year, Christmas and New Year's and all that stuff. And I said, you know, you might have a point here. But I've got a lot of things to do, and I'll get back with you after the first of the year. And, oh boy, I wish I had stayed in AA because my life took a big turn. Remember I told you I'd always got away with everything and stuff like that? Well, I ended up New Year's Eve 1974, and I was 26 years old. I ended up killing somebody. And when I left that morning on New Year's Eve and started drinking, I started drinking about 10 or 10:30 in the morning. I just had no idea that I would be in prison and end up in that situation at all, or that I was going to kill anybody. I mean, in a sense, to me, it was like going to the 7-Eleven to pick up a pack of cigarettes and you never come back. You know, that's sort of what happened. And it was because I was drinking. I can tell you this, I would have never done what I did if I hadn't been drinking, and that's the truth. It's the absolute honest God's truth. So, in any case, I ended up in the slammer. I ended up having an experience. Some of you maybe that haven't had that experience can maybe take a lead from mine and reflect on it. Maybe you don't want to go there. I know this. If you ever get there, you're for gonna sure say, what the hell am I doing here? You know, and how can I get out of here? And, you know, stuff like that. And I know there's guys out there that spend in the slammer too. But I ended up being in there 6.5 years before I got out. And in the time that I was there, I went from various institutions. The first jail they put me in was full of 11 outlaws, the motorcycle gang. And I couldn't believe I survived that, to tell you the truth, but I did. Those guys are really, truly bad news. And, you know, I don't know if we got any outlaws out there tonight. You want to talk to me about it after the meeting? We'll take it up then. In any case, when I went on up the road, I ended up in Rayford, and This was in 75. They had tremendous overcrowding up there and all that sort of stuff. And there was blood all over the place all the time. Like it was a bloodbath. That's what it was. They just did stuff that you can't imagine. And it was inmate against inmate. And, you know, you could die for a pork chop. And that's the truth. It was really, they had a movie on Saturday night. I'll just tell you, somebody, you know, dealing with fear in sobriety sometimes is a problem for a lot of us. And one of the things that I had up there, they had a movie theater that you went to, and they would take different sections. And my night to go, they had to rotate the sections. There'd be about 300 people go to the movie a night. And it was like a regular theater. You know, you go in their seats and everything, and they close the doors and play the movie. Well, if you didn't go to the movie, you were in trouble because it meant you were afraid. And if you ever showed that you were afraid, you were in big, big trouble. I mean, boy, you got a life you didn't want to live then, I'm telling you. But in any case, what happened is you go to the movies, and every Saturday night, the lights would go out. They'd get everybody in there. It'd be pitch black. And you'd hear this, you know, and the lights would come back on, and there's bodies laying here or there, and they come in with inmates with stretchers and stuff, and the guards, and they pick them up and haul them out of there, you know, and everything like that. And then they would turn the lights back out, and everybody watched the movie. And that's where they took care of business every Saturday night. It was like that, every single one of them. And so I used to stand in the line going to the movie, saying the 23rd Psalm, you know, that part about, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. And, you know, so on. The whole thing. I did it the whole time I was there. Because I really thought I'd never get out of there. I really, truly, just there was so much blood. I saw people, you know, that made booze in there to keep drinking and stuff like that. They'd sell 4 gallons and think they're going to drink the 5th gallon that they made just to, you know, that pays for everything, and they get drunk too. And the guys about the and think they're going to drink the 5th gallon that they made just to, you know, that pays for everything, and they get drunk too. And the guys about the other gallons decide they're going to drink the 5th one too, and they'll kill him for it. And that's all there is to it. And so in any case, when I got out of there, I hadn't been out of the, I ended up being transferred to Avon Park, and I hadn't been out of the institution walls for the whole time that I was in there. And I got out on a legal thing when I got out. It was sort of like I was in one day and out the next. And I didn't have any community control or work release or anything. I was just in there today, and they told me in 7 days you're leaving. And when I left, I walked out with a t-shirt on my back, cut-off shorts, and flip-flops. And that's what I had for my existence as far as possessions. And I had $312 in cash to start my new life. And I ended up, I got out and went to Fort Lauderdale. First, there's a guy I used to work for that put me up for 30 days or so down there. And I was terrified. I mean, the stuff in the street, I mean, it just, God, I got out of there and hamburgers had gone from maybe 50 cents to $1.30 or something. And, you know, I was just, it was like I was in China all over again. I didn't know anything, the models of the cars. I'm a car nut. I didn't know anything about what was going on here. And I was full of fear, terror, bewilderment, and all that kind of stuff again. And the only way I knew how to do that was to take a drink, and that's exactly what I did. Now, you would think that a person that had been in the slammer and been through all that stuff as a consequence of your drinking would surely not pick up a drink almost immediately after you got out, but I did. You know, you would think I would say, just in good sense, common sense thinking, say, man, I ain't ever doing that again. Look where that got me. But it didn't. It wasn't enough to do it. No matter what the consequences were, I was incapable of not drinking. And that's what I did. And it wasn't long until my drinking had turned on me. I had the fear, terror, paranoia, bewilderment, that feeling that people were out to get me all the time and stuff like that, and I was just going crazy with it. And I went and saw a head shrinker over here at ORMC, and I got in there on a, I don't know, charity act or whatever, but they put me in counseling. Yeah, I thought he'd mistakenly put me in an alcohol group, you know, by mistake, that he was just going to have me there for a little while until he got room somewhere else and put me in with the other folks. And come to find out, he was an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told him I had to drink to function. He knew that, you know. I stuttered when I was sober. I was so full of fear. And this is the early days of, like, 81, and Bill and was around then, and a few, Al Verna didn't come to town until a little later, I believe, if my memory's right. But in any case, I went to the Jackson Street, because one of the things that he did for me was he said, we agreed I was going to stop drinking for 30 days and go to AA and all that sort of stuff, and I did that. And, you know, my life changed. I mean, I'd gone there, put in the 30 days, and, you know, the fear, terror, and bewilderment had left me. You know, I didn't get up in the morning with that absolute disgust and hate that I'd had for myself when I first went to meeting. I remember looking at myself in the mirror after I'd gotten drunk when I didn't plan to, and I would say, you son of a bitch, how could you do it again? You know, I mean, that's what I said to myself. I hated who I was. And but I saw people here in AA that didn't drink, and this guy had told me to monitor this thing when I went back out drinking, report back to the group. And anyway, the first day back drinking, it was great. There's nothing like a tall, cool beer when you're thirsty. And second day was one of those days that you splash the stuff on and you're getting ready to go out and thinking good things are going to happen. It's going to be a great night. And somehow, next morning, it just didn't work out that way. Well, everybody can have a, you know, just a off night now and then. And so the third night I went out, I came back and I cussed the landlady. I was living off of Paramore over here, and I cussed her up one side and down the other and all this and that and everything. And the guys in the house told me the next morning, you know, that lady had no idea the mouth that I had on me coming from prison like that, because that's a specialty in there, swearing. And so in any case, they told me this stuff that I had done, and I couldn't believe it. And it's like, oh shit, I'm going to get kicked out. Where am I going? To the Orange Grove? You know, when you get kicked off of Paramore, it doesn't look real good. Your options aren't what you'd like. So, in any case, I came back to the club with a new, renewed vigor and determination to try to stay sober and get this thing. And I did. I came back to meetings over at Jackson Street, and there was a lot of good folks there. Had a great message. There's not very many of them around anymore. But in any case, I could get 60 days together, and lo and behold, I'd be driving down the street, minding my own business, and there's a 7-Eleven, and I'd just whip in and start drinking. And I couldn't figure that out, because I knew that alcohol, you know, that three-day period when I went back with the landlady and I did all this stuff, I had the hatred, the guilt, and remorse for what I'd done. Everything was back in full, the fear, terror, everything, in 3 days flat. And I knew that the only thing that changed my life was the fact that I picked up a drink. And so, you know, there was no question to me that I was an alcoholic, and I couldn't predict my behavior, what was going to happen, or anything. And the fact of the matter was, I hated myself and my life so much at that time that, to me, my options were either get sober or die, because I couldn't stand it. If I looked into my drinking career, I lived through all this stuff that had happened in my life, bad, all these things, only to suffer another day. You know, I got out of prison. Here I am. You know, my head's full of crap, and I hate who I am, all over again, you know? Every time anything happened, I lived through it. I had two or three suicide attempts in my past, too. Lived through them, too. You know, that's discouraging when you wake up after you've tried a serious, you know, suicide attempt, and you're still alive. It's like, damn, you know? I just wanted the pain and the suffering to stop. You know, I just couldn't take it anymore. So that's how I believed, for me, it was get sober or die. I either had to get this program or shoot myself. And it's that simple. Because I could see if I continued to drink, I was going to suffer again over and over and over again. And that's one of the things that I've learned in this program. For for me is that if I ever go back out to drink again, that's what I got to look forward to. More crap, and I'm not going to die. You know, a lot of people, they get lucky. They go out and get hit by a car or something, and they die. That's not going to happen to me. I can tell by my past. I go out, get hit, I'm going to live through that, maybe with a leg gone or half of my mind or who knows what, you know. And I just can't take it. So, like I said, I put everything I had into these 60-day periods, and it worked. I did everything they said, eat sweets, come to meetings, so on and so forth. And yet I would go out and take another drink against my own will. I could not do that. And I heard a guy say in a meeting one night that he had had the same problem for a long time, and that he hadn't asked God to remove the obsession or the compulsion to drink because he was afraid he really would. And that was me. You know, I hadn't asked for God's help, and because I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. I absolutely couldn't figure what I would do, where I would go, what I would become. But I was so beat up, I got on my knees and I asked God to remove that obsession and compulsion to drink. That was April 7th, 1982. And I haven't had a drink since. And, you know, I've had to do a lot of things. I got with Bill back in those days, and we did steps, and I came to meetings after meetings. I think I went to 10 meetings a week for the first 2 years that I was in AA, and I needed every one of them. See, one of the things I found out after being here a while was that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any useful information on how to live. I just didn't. You know, I never learned it growing up. I didn't know about anger. I didn't know about caring for anybody, loving people, how to be socially or anything like that. I was bankrupt. And you'll hear them say they're mentally, physically, and spiritually bankrupt. And I was all three. And but I saw people who had what I wanted. And matter of fact, I'll tell a little story about Bill. You know, it's not uncommon for an alcoholic that comes into a program to hate their sponsor. I got one out there wanting to cut my head off when he first met me. But he's sober 10 or 12 years. But anyway, he got over it. Anyhow, when I saw Bill around the club here, he used to be around the club all the time, he was always shaking people's hands, saying hi to them, greeting them, and stuff like that. And my first reaction to that is, what the hell is he doing, running for governor? I hate people like that, you know. And after being here a while, you know, I understand today, and I know what that's all about. And thank God people shook my hand and asked me to come back and went to coffee and spent time with me and, you know, helped me walk this path. Because I'll tell you what, my whole life has turned around completely different than anything I would have ever imagined. I love the pages in the big book on page 62 and 63. There's quite a bit of meat there on the third step. And that third step, as you read in there, the prayer and everything, is exactly what I did. I mean, if you ask me how I do the third step, it's right there. That's it. And I've revisited it many times in sobriety because things happen in our lives. They just show up, you know, unexpectedly. We have no clue what's coming around the next curve or bump in the road. And that's the only thing I have to hang on to, AA and the third step. I come back and hold on to AA like it was a knot in the end of the rope and just don't drink. See it through sober. That's important beyond imagination, because what I find is on the other side of it, it wasn't as big a deal as I thought it was, and maybe God was doing something for my benefit that I had no clue could happen that way, or that I was to be used for somebody else's benefit, and I had become useful to God by this process, whatever it is. And today, I love being useful to God and being used for His purposes in whatever way He would have me. I pretty much never left this group, the Central Orlando group, since 81 when I came in. And in that length length of time, I've had umpteen miracles. You know, as many of you know, my kids came back into my life. Some of the highlights, I remember one time my daughter, we went out to SeaWorld, and I just would have never thought, because there was a time when the kids really didn't think very much of me, and that's the truth. And we were walking along, and she stuck her arm in mine, and she says, "You know, Dad, I'm really glad you're my dad. You know, I've been an asshole my whole life, pretty much." And, she gave me the benefit of the doubt, and we got back together, and the kids ended up coming down to Florida and stuff like that. And, just an incredible journey for me. I thought my life was over when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, but the fact of the matter is it had just started. That's why when they say in page 63, we are reborn. And I mean, that's, to me, I just see that so well, because I had lived this complete other life, and from that point on, I began to change slowly and surely to become the human being that I've always wanted to be. And I am who I want to be today, and I love myself, and I like the life that I've been given. You know, it's a miracle that, and a grace of God that I've stayed sober. But the fact of the matter is, there's just so many good things that happened to me in my sobriety as a result of this program. You know, my kids are grown, and they're practically the age I was when I came in here. And, they've got wonderful lives going. I hope the cycle of insanity is broken, you know. Because that's what's really wrong with us, you know. We're insane regarding to alcohol. We don't think so when we come in, but so often, you know, a drink becomes a good idea. And yet when we look at the past that we went through and all the shit that we put ourselves into because of a drink, no sane person on earth would ever pick up a drink. But we do. And that's the part that we've got to have God restore us to sanity. And it's by the process of going through these steps and doing these things. It's not about reading them. It's not about intellectualizing them and prophesizing what you think this means and stuff like that. It's about doing it. And I have seen people over and over that are willing to do it, that get the result, that are happy. And I had some heart attacks earlier this year. I had like 3 of them. And, those are things that come up in our life one day at a time when we don't think, everything's going on fine and dandy. We got our own little schedule and plan. I didn't have my heart attack scheduled that day. Not at all. And, I was given an opportunity to get through that, grace of God and the doctors and one thing another. And lo and behold, I've had now 3 operations, 3 heart operations. And I thought all the time I might have to worry about this heart problem that I've got. I'm going to have to start taking care of that. Well, the last time I went in, they told me I got full-blown cancer. You know, I'm loaded with it. And, the heart attack wasn't what I needed to worry about at all. the funny thing about the program is that, I have found a heart attack's no big deal. I mean, just like they said. And I've survived again today, so the cancer's no big deal either. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'm supposed to be worrying about thunderstorms. See, that's what I found, is that I can turn my faith and trust to God to give me solutions to everyday problems and learn how to live. And the folks in Alcoholics Anonymous have shown me one day at a time how to get through this thing and give me useful tools that I can learn how to better myself, my fellow man, and the world that I live in. And, Bill always used to talk about when you got sober, you got your teeth fixed. Well, I got that. Getting a Timex. I got that too. And I found this the other day. I'll tell you what, this is the coolest Timex I ever seen in my life. It's a Timex collectible, solid gold. And I don't know if you can see it, but it says love in it. And in the O, there's a Timex plug in it. So anyway, my cup runneth over, and I got my teeth fixed and my Timex now. So. Thank you.